Hello and welcome to You Really Shouldn't Have, with me, James Warwick, the podcast where each week I sit down with a different guest as we discuss their career and unwrap a story on the worst gift they've ever been given. Now, this week actually marks a whole year that You Really Shouldn't Have has been available. It's been a whole year since we launched the podcast. I'm absolutely astounded by how far it's gone. I mean, we've had downloads in well over 40 countries around the world and a whole host of fantastic guests throughout all of those episodes that I could never have imagined to have on the show when we first launched it. So thank you so much for all of the support. I hope you've been enjoying the show and hopefully another year of bad gifts yet to come. Joining me on this week's episode is stand-up comedian and presenter Tom Deacon. Tom stopped by to discuss his career in comedy, his TV and radio work, and of course, he lets me in on the worst gift he's ever been given. So Tom, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
It's good to see you again, because I mean, it's been 10 years since we were last in the same room, and we're not in the same room due to COVID. But back when I did stand up, a long while ago now, and I've spoken about it a number of times on the show, I did a gig with Mr. Tom Deacon, and I was just telling him that he headlined the gig, and he didn't believe me that he was the headline act of the gig.
whoa. Let's be very clear, James. What I said was that would be a poor gig if I'm headlining. And what I'm doing there is doing a classic comedian self-deprecating stuff. But I have headlined a few times, but the particular gig you're talking about is the Cellar in Bracknell. And it's a beautiful, beautiful gig. And it's always a delight. Always a well-behaved crowd, I believe.
It was from memory. My memory's a bit hazy of the crowd. But the gig itself was a bit of a strange one. Because I remember you came in towards the end to do your set. You weren't there at the beginning. So I think you missed quite a bit of the madness. So
yeah, classic Tom Deacon, just rocks up, Mr. Rock and Roll star. I was probably really busy eating, James, to be honest with you. And I've rocked up and gone, I don't need to see the rest of the gig. I'll just do my time and do one. But yeah, that's, by the way, just for everyone listening, that is not normally how I'm normally there at the start.
Oh, absolutely. Watch the show. Absolutely.
So you caught me off guard there, James. So I rocked up, and then what happened?
Well, here's what happened. So I was hounding the promoter of said gig for like a while, basically begging her for a 10-minute spot. And I think finally she got fed up with my emails and said, oh, we've got this gig and Tom Deacon's doing a warm-up stuff for his Edinburgh show. So come down, you can do 10 minutes before him. I was like, oh, great. So I remember I get there and there's all these like kids there. I mean, I say kids, like I was like 19 at the time, Tom. But they're all these like 14, 15, 16-year-old kids there. And they were like from some sort of drama group. And essentially what happened and what you missed was the first half of this show was like them putting on some improv thing. And then the second half was me and then you.
Do you know what? This vaguely rings a bell.
Maybe you turned up. So my memory is that I was sat at the back of the room and they come on and they start doing the improv stuff. But it became pretty clear pretty quickly that they had essentially watched like 4 weeks worth of Mock the Week and a few Russell Howard DVDs like before they came on and did their thing. Because I remember them just literally ripping off jokes that had been on the TV like weeks before. And I remember looking at the promoter like, how are you allowing this to go on? Like, how are you allowing all these kids to just rip off TV comedians and get laughs for it? But that's my memory of it. And then there was a break, and then I did 10 minutes, and then you did like 45.
Blimey, I had 45 minutes 10 years ago. That, do you know what? It vaguely rings a bell, and I think I deliberately didn't turn up on time to make sure I missed. And I know that sounds rude, but I think when you've been in the industry of comedy, and I've, you know, James and everyone listening, I've done over, you know, 3,000 gigs, I reckon, in the 15 years that I've been going. So when a promoter says, by the way, I've got these young guys who are going to get up and give stand up a go, that's the time that you normally leave, unless you want to stick around and watch essentially a car crash happen. Okay. But it could go one of two ways, but it was most likely to be that, wasn't it? And you witnessed that. And then, and this is something I always think, because, you know, I believe that your stand-up career didn't last for too long, James. You moved into other fields.
I did.
But Did I say anything nice? You know, when you're thinking, like, I don't remember this 10 years ago, like, vividly. I might have a picture of it in my head. It's a still. That's how my memory is now. It's a still, not a moving video. How did your set go, and how did we meet?
Well, I remember my set went fairly well. I remember I did some material about a prostitute in Amsterdam, and the promoter, who was a woman, didn't particularly like some of the lines that I put in that bit, and accused me of being misogynistic, and I didn't know what misogynistic meant, so I had to go home and look that word up.
Brilliant.
Because I'm pretty sure every gig I'd done before that, I think she was like the first female promoter who's like night I'd done. And I think because I'd done that material so many times in front of like bloke promoters, it's such like a weird sexist thing to say, but it's almost like that they didn't pick up on it. I mean, I did it in front of like a woman who was putting on a night, and she really didn't like it, but she liked the rest of the set. But I remember she accused me of being misogynistic in places, and I just went, oh, okay, because I had no idea what that word meant, and I had to go and look it up.
Wow.
But you were very kind. You said you really enjoyed the set, and you said I did a great job. And I remember you dropped me a message on Twitter afterwards as well.
Oh, what a nice guy. Good.
What a great guy.
I'm glad that went, that, you know, that was the end of that story in terms of, you know, I said something nice and supportive. I think there's nothing worse than in an industry that you're working in when people don't offer any, not even a critique, but just don't give you a little bit of joy or respect, or just something you take away and you go, do you know what? Look, I know I'm not quite there. I know that particular material about Amsterdam wasn't for everybody's liking, but I'm going to go away. I'm going to find out what misogynistic means. And then I'm going to go back to the next gig and I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. And I think that was really nice that I was able to offer something. And then the promoter you're talking about is called is Catherine, and she's a fantastic promoter and just an all-round lovely person, and I think that just shows how comedy has evolved over the last 10 years, that a lot of it was you go into a quite hostile environment and you have to have material that resonates with the majority of the audience, and what the liking of the time was, I guess, those adventure laddie stories that really resonated with the audience in that room, and how audiences are changing as years go on. And then you get, you know, that material wouldn't necessarily go down very well now, maybe.
Oh, definitely not. It's funny you say that, because I was looking through some of my old material that I found on my computer not long ago, and I remember looking at it going, nah, that wouldn't get away with that now. No, wouldn't get away with that one.
Yeah. But yet, and it's interesting as a comedian that you write or you tell stories, that I'm mainly a storyteller, or you write a joke to fit the time or things that are happening with your viewpoint. And it is so interesting that changes. Like, I look back at maybe that show I did there that night, and oddly enough, I've got my book in front of me from that time, and it says Bracknell underlined. I was very neat in my writing. And it has my mum, a bit of material about per kilo. There's a joke I did on a Rob Brydon show, actually, and mates Brighton. And that I know, that joke about Brighton is about how my mates that I grew up with in Southampton essentially were very fearful of homosexuality. And therefore that joke is really about how they thought if we're going to Brighton, that they might end up being gay, and yet that is something that's sort of so juvenile, but it was of like I'm talking from a perspective that's what it was like growing up when I was at school, and you've got these mates, and I go down to do a gig and they came with me and they thought, oh no, we're gonna turn gay, and yet that's a real story. But now you just, that would seem very odd to an audience. They'd be like, that is so 2011, that material. You know.
Well, enough on my failed career, Tom. We'll talk more about you. So when did your interest in performing and comedy first begin? Was it always an ambition from an early age?
Yeah, I think it was, James. Secondary school, I really liked drama. I liked performing. And I loved watching comedy with my stepdad. And I just loved it. I think there was something about comedians, whether we were watching Morecambe and Wise to Vic and Bob or The Fast Show, all these shows on TV. And I was like, oh, everybody loves the funny person. That's what I want to be. And I think there's this idea of being the performer, being the life and soul of a party. That's the person you sort of emulate or want to be like. So I knew that I wanted to perform, and I went down the acting route for a while. And it wasn't until I went to university that I was able to really try stand-up comedy. I went to Exeter and they had a stand-up comedy night there called the Three Fat Fish, which is sadly no more. And we had all the comedians of that period, like Russell Howard, you mentioned earlier, to Reginald E. Hunter, to Alex Horn. I remember watching him from Taskmaster,
yeah,
where you people will know him now. But he was just phenomenal. He used to do this whole bit about beatboxing. It would be a track that would play and you didn't know when he was beatboxing or it was the CD playing Justin Timberlake. It was fantastic. Like one of those, I'd watch that and go, that is what I want to do. I want to be able to travel, tour, and just bring a bit of joy to people's lives. So, and also I decided to give up on acting because you have to keep auditioning and that sounded far too bloody difficult. So I went down the stand-up comedy route and did a competition when I left university for the funniest student, which seems like forever ago, but I did that. And that gave me that lead into, to making a career. I had a good 5 minutes and then you build that up and eventually you do an hour in Edinburgh and yeah. And then I've gone on to present and do a whole host of other things. So yeah, it was, I guess it built from, I love comedy. I would like to do that. That seems a very cool thing to do.
You mentioned the presenting there and I was going to touch on that because I remember the first time I remember encountering you on TV was when you did the 519 show, which must seem like a lifetime ago for you now because it was a long while ago. You had some big guests on there though for its time.
Oh, massive. For those who do not know what the 519 show, it is odd that you've brought it up because whenever people ask me about the time of doing Radio 1 or doing Coppa 90, the Eurofan, where I travel around watching Champions League football, no one ever mentions the 519 show. And yet that was really where I started or cut my teeth presenting. I always wore a hat, a new era hat, and I had long hair. I was out of university and I was sort of thrust into this teen world where teenagers watched an online show, which was kind of ahead of its time, really. YouTube wasn't really that place yet. And so we had this online show which had a YouTube vibe about it. And yeah, you're right, we did have some really big guests on at the time. Jedward.
Yeah,
I don't want to go on about it. who else? We had singers, we had Jason Derulo, we had, it was just whoever was on that PR circuit with them. Pixie Lott, I'm just throwing names now out. We would just have them on and they would come on to a live show and then leave again. It would be a 15 minute episode and then we'd go back to work the next day and create content and make stuff so it was a 5 day a week show, which ended up on BBC Two. So then it was on Radio One. I was doing that show. So it was mad for its time. Think the best way I can describe it is like a Japanese TV show, which you're like, this is insane and bonkers. What is happening here? To trying to be like a music show meets teenagers getting shout outs to just all round silliness. And it was a really fun show to do. And I did it for two and a half years.
You mentioned Radio One. I was going to move on to it because I guess that's where the transition went from the TV with BBC straight onto the radio. What are your major memories of your time with Radio One? And was there a lot of pressure in those early shows with it being such a large audience? You know, it's probably one of the biggest stations in the country.
Yeah, it was. I mean, so I've mentioned about my performing or wanting to perform or wanting to be in the spotlight, I guess. Not be famous, but just wanted to entertain. That's essentially what I wanted. I had no radio experience, and because BBC is all connected under one big umbrella, they were looking to have, the connection started with Annie Mack and Nick Grimshaw. They had a Sunday night show and it was teen orientated. You had Kelly Osbourne doing a show called The Surgery, and you'd have The Chart Show with Reggie Yates. And that was the kind of the mix. And then they were like, hey, I'll tell you what we'll do. Why don't you, Tom, do some voice up teenagers that are emailing or texting into the show, record them, and then we'll play them out. And from that, that led me to, I think Josie Long, who's a fantastic comedian, was doing exactly the same thing as well. And I kind of took over, and then they said, why don't you pilot a show? So I did one that was not team-based, which was more about my love of music and being a bit more of a comedian as opposed to a teen presenter. But they said, no, you've got the job, but if you could just keep it teen. So so I had to, you know, you get to choose tracks for the weekend that will be played out. And I'd be saying, oh, I love this Ben Howard guy. Like, no one's heard of him. I think he's brilliant. We should play that. Or a song, Death by Diamonds and Pearls. And my producer would be like, yeah, that's really good, Tom. And I'm glad you've got a taste in music. But if you could choose the Bieber track or the Selena Gomez, because that fits with your audience. So my introduction to Radio 1 was very much, you're the teen guy, make sure you keep it teen. And yet I would say, like, in my prime of 23, 24, going out, being in London, but not being able to quite talk about those things. So it was an interesting time, but yet working with the likes of Zane Lowe and, you know, Sarah Cox was brilliant. And, you know, just this, like Annie Nightingale, who is an institution. She's just phenomenal character. And Giles Peterson, like doing a couple of early breakfast shifts where I was in at 4 a.m. You've got Giles Peterson, this like guru of music, passing over to me going, next up is Tom Deacon with the early breakfast show. And I'd be like, Giles Peterson's a legend. And then pulling up the fader going, hi, it's me, Tom Deacon. So, it was definitely a rude awakening to finding out who I was as a person and my presenting style. And yeah, I've got a lot of fun memories there.
We mentioned Eurofan earlier as well, and I was going to bring up Eurofan because I was such a big fan of it back when you were doing it. And I hope after the pandemic, they might let you do another series of it, because I really think they should bring it back, Tom, because it was brilliant. Of all the countries you had to visit during your Champions League journeys, which one was the most memorable for you?
Very good question. Thanks, James. Very good question. It was mad because for those who hadn't seen it, it was essentially me becoming a fan of the home team. So there'd be a Champions League match, and we went to Malaga, to Cluj in Romania, to Dortmund, to Real Madrid, to Atletico, like all just traveling around. And I would take on board that team that is the home team and support them, find out what it's all about. I think the most random one was Romania, Cefere, they're called. They were playing Man United, and I just loved it. It was a kind of like a broken stadium split in two. You've got the Hungarian Romanian fans, and then you've got the Romanian fans. And then you find out the history that the country was divided, and yet one section of the home fans sing one song, but the others don't sing because they're Romanian. And it's just like, it was just bonkers. And, you know, going with like 50 strong Cefere fans up to Man United fans, it kind of like, it reminded me of like France 98. We were heading up to them, and I was asking my translator guy and good friend, actually, now a guy called Eke, I was like, what are we doing? He said, we're going to turn up in front of all the Man United fans, and we're going to sing at them, and we're going to challenge them to a sing off. And I was like, this is bloody bonkers. I love it. So we're just there in front of all these cafes with the tables outside, just started getting into song, and then the Man United fans stood up and sang one back. And then we were like besties. So I think that was a real eye opener to what football can do. It can bring people together, and I loved it. But that's not to take away anything from traveling to America to watch football, to traveling to Bermuda to watch football with Copa 90, to even going to the World Cup in 2014 in Brazil. Like, so I've been to some amazing places, but I think Cefere just stands out for me just for that eye-opening experience.
I was going to stick with sports because I know more recently you've been involved in presenting esports content, and I wondered if that was something you had an interest in prior to being approached to present the content.
Yeah, I've always been a gamer, but I was unaware that there was the elite level one above. My level was university, you know, split screen, playing FIFA, playing Halo, you know, having a couple of drinks, let's say that, and playing with my housemates, my best mates, and And that was a really cool, fun way of, you know, connecting with other people at my uni. And then to find out there's an esports where you've got professionals who are making money from gaming, I was like, wow, I'll never get to host or work in that field. And then out of nowhere, when I just finished working at Capital, I was doing a breakfast show with them, I got contacted by someone I knew at uni, and they were like, hey, you love gaming and you love sports, so why didn't I put you forward for this presenting job? And out from that grew something with Gfinity, the company I called. We were looking after FIFA, Counter-Strike, Rocket League, Street Fighter, which is incredible in terms of the fans and the pop-offs when they celebrate after a victory. It really is electric. It really does go off. And I love that energy and vibe they bring to hosting F1 esports, which has been kind of more recent with the whole pandemic that we had. We had virtual Grand Prix where the F1 drivers were involved. So to answer your question, that's been my journey. I didn't have any prior experience, loved gaming, but then found myself in this world where you've got the best of the best taking on each other, and massively fallen in love with it.
Now, before we move on to bad gifts, I thought it was only fair if we talk about the worst gig you ever had.
All right, here we go. I'm gonna go with it. I'm not gonna say Canterbury. That's the second one. So you asked for the first, so you will get the first gig.
It was Bracknell, wasn't it? In 2011.
Do you know what? There was this guy on before, and he was doing a story about Amsterdam and Ladies of the Night. And I was like, damn him. He's done all my stuff that I was going to talk about. No, Cambridge. It was the day of the royal wedding. And I went to Cambridge, and I was with another comedian called Jimmy McGee. And we were doing our extended show, so an hour in the theatre room. And for some unknown reason, we arrived. The stage manager says, look, there's only 20 people in, but we're going to go ahead. It'll be good fun. And I was like, oh, brilliant. Now that's fine. 20's fine. Good way of, you know, testing out material. And then all of a sudden, about 5 minutes later, he came back and he said, oh, hang on a minute. It's now gone up to 40. You've got 20 guys on a stag do that are joining.
Oh, no.
And I was like, well, this sounds different because you've got a theater audience who've come to see an extended show and themes and not jokes every minute. And now we've got a stag do. And I walked out to silence because the stage manager didn't play any music, and just got berated for about 15 minutes and batted away. It was a real kind of how people think stand-up comedy is, that they shout something, you put them down, you do a joke, and then they shout again, and then you put them down. It was really weird. That's not how comedy works. It's
no.
The comedian is telling the stories. Someone might want to get involved, and then you deal with that, and then you carry on. But this went on for 20 minutes, and eventually Jimmy McGee came onto the stage and went, just get off. This isn't a gig. This isn't playable. And I fought so hard to sort of nullify them. And I couldn't do the show. I was just doing old bits of material to keep them quiet. So I came off. They got a refund. They were asked to leave. And I went back out and did my material. But the rest of the audience were so shell-shocked. It was just horrific. And I've never felt so empty as that gig. I didn't deal with it in the right way. I didn't readdress the crowd. I didn't start again. I didn't say, well, that was a bit weird. I didn't make jokes about it. I was so kind of, I need to do this hour show. Let's start again. And it didn't work. And I fast forward a year on, I was a tour support for Chris Ramsey, a really good mate of mine. And we were back there, and I told the story about how horrific it was. And I made it funny now, and some people were laughing. And a guy, after I'd been on, came up to me in the interval, and he said, that was horrific. I was there in the audience.
No.
He said, it was genuinely like me deciding whether I wanted to see comedy again. It was that brutal. So, but he said, I'm really glad you've got some material out of it. So I guess worst gig, a real kind of like, do I want to do this? This is soul destroying. So then coming back and knowing, yeah, I think I did make the right choice to keep going. Oh my
God. Now, Tom, it's time for me to ask you, what is the worst gift you've ever been given?
Okay, I'm going to hit you with this. It was 6 years ago. I was given 3 Olympic lifting PT sessions. Now, you cannot see me, but I am what I'd like to call lean and mean.
Yes.
I am not an Olympic lifting sort of physique. And it was, I guess, the most ill-judged gift I've ever been given, in as much as I was like, why would you possibly get me Olympic lifting lessons? I mean, what do you think I'm going to possibly get from it? And they were actually a session. So you've got the biggest hench people. I'm talking male and female, and me. And what's so demoralizing is it turning up for the Olympic lifting classes where you're going to learn how to do snatch, clean and press, jerk, all of these technical terms I've never forgotten. And when I got there, they took a look at me. This is genuinely true. And the PT guy was like, don't worry. I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to start with you with air weights.
Oh, no.
I kid you not. He said, we're just going to focus on the form in the first class. So you're going to pretend I am lifting the weights so as to build up confidence. It's traumatizing. That's a gift that I know was with good intentions. And I did get into it by the third session. I was allowed a weight and a bar at that point. But yeah, genuinely crushing. That's up there with the worst gifts of... But you know what? I think maybe they did it specifically so that as a comedian, I'm able to tell a funny story. But do you know what? There comes a point as a comic where you're like, I don't want things to be funny for me to tell people in the future. I just want normal. I just want nothing to happen where it's not a story and I'm not scarred from it.
Maybe with the air weights, they saw your esports stuff and thought, well, we're starting with the air weights.
Yeah, yeah. You know what? It's interesting about you say that about the esports people. That there's a lot of people that they'll game for 6 hours. They'll treat it as a job. They're like, particularly the F1 esports drivers, 6 hours on the rig, the wheel, pedals, minute details they're changing to get 1/10,000 of a second faster. And then they just go to the gym. So like they treat it as a job and get hench. I think the idea before it's just going to be quite large, unhealthy people in esports. It's kind of flipped on its head. People are like, I do this to get paid. Now I'm going to go and get hench. It's a fascinating world that's changing. But yeah, the air weights were much needed for me.
Now, wrapping up, I've got two questions for you. The first one is, if you could go back to your childhood and rescue a gift that you don't have anymore, what would you go and rescue?
That's an incredible question. All right. There was, and I can't remember the cartoon at the time, but essentially they were like these knights. Someone will know this. You know, like when you went to Blockbuster and you like took the VHS out. That's how old I am. There was this particular cartoon. I absolutely loved it. It was on TV on Saturday morning cartoons. And essentially these knights, these soldier guys would have something come out of the shield that was on their front of their chest. It would like, they would have like, I guess like a spirit animal. This sounds really weird. And they would fly out and I bought the figures. My mum bought me the little figurines. And had like a hologram on the front of them. And I took them to Spain with me and I loved them. I must've been about 4 or 5 and I buried them in the sand as you do to find them again, but I lost them. So someone in Spain had an amazing time. They just unearthed this treasure. That genuinely haunts me. The fact that, you know, I learned my lesson from burying them. I can't remember the name of this cartoon, but that was pretty traumatizing. I would like to rescue them quite literally.
And if you could go right back to the beginning of your career and give yourself a gift to help to get where you are now, what gift would you give yourself?
Do you know what? I sometimes think about my career and I think, like Samson, when he cut off his hair, did he lose his powers, right? And I used to have really long hair and I feel like my blasé style, kind of not rude, but just more kind of like, hey, just go with the flow. Like I'm just chilled out and easy. Got me these opportunities. And I was always nice to people. My motto was don't be a dick. And that's kind of the motto I kept. And then when I started taking things more seriously, less offers came in. So I think what I'd do is go back to that guy who had just left university. He was making his way in stand-up comedy. I go, hey, just keep doing what you're doing. Don't try and be what other people want you to be. And like, Tom, you should get a haircut. You should do this. You should do that. And you think, oh, if I do that, then more opportunities come. No, go back and tell myself, just do you. You'll be absolutely fine.
And finally, Tom, where can people find out more about you and what you do?
They found out everything, James. You do not need to find out anything more about me. This has been an extensive inside, kind of like a behind, through the keyhole, essentially. That sounded ruder than I meant. People can find out all about me on my Instagram, Tom Deacon Comedy. And if they want, can watch a new show that's coming out, actually, called Celebrity Esports, which is going to be a lot of fun, where I'm hosting that with the likes of Jimmy Carr, Joel Dommett, a whole host of people from Love Island. So if you're into that, they'll all be on it. So yeah, that's coming out very soon. And yeah, it'd be nice to hear from people.
Fantastic. Well, Tom, it's been great to have you here. Thanks so much for stopping by the show.
Absolute pleasure. Don't mind me. I'm going to go back to Spain and start digging some sand to see if I can find those figures.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of You Really Shouldn't Have. Be sure to subscribe to us on your chosen podcast service to make sure you never miss another episode. You can find us on both Twitter and Instagram at Bad Gifts Pod, as well as online at badgiftspod.com.